This is Betty Smith. February 25th, 1990. Not Without Aphrodite. Tape 4 of 6.
I'd like to say something about the central desire in us. I think this is what I was driving at part of the time yesterday. Whatever is central in one's desire world, that is arising out of the essence of what you are, I think that partakes of Aphrodite. It doesn't mean has to be specifically a desire for a lover, desire for a mate, desire for a huge experience. It may take many, many different forms, even the desire for the spirit and the desire for, the very uplifting, even a philosophical base for one's life or a spiritual base can have. When it's consuming, it can have a real Aphrodite force in it, I think. Now, this is distinguished from ego wish or any kind of ego goal, like the central drive of my life is to make $1 million, or the central drive of my life. That's not Aphrodite. That's already colored very much with the culture and the ego and the hero journey and many things. But not to put that down, but that is not the central desire that rises out of one's nature. Behind that, I want to make $1 million, might be found the desire in one's nature that Aphrodite has given. That is, I want to be satisfied. I want abundance. See, that would be the Aphrodite aspect. But not a specific achievement goal or a... And I think what we were trying to hear yesterday, we were tuning our ears to hear Epiphyle, even though she was upsetting us terribly with the moral implications of her action. We were attempting, I think, to hear the desire, the Aphrodite desire in her, beyond the materialism, beyond I can show off if I have a necklace from the Queen of Thebes, beyond that, something she wanted from life that she didn't have. What one does with that desire, how one comes to terms with it, of course, is what the journey is all about. Now, the meaning of Aphrodite's jewels, I'd just like to say a few sentences. You can never make an equivalent statement from a mythological image to a statement. But I would just like to amplify it a little bit. Of course, they're beautiful. The necklace is beautiful. And beauty is a certain realization in the moment, a certain fittingness in the moment, a certain satisfaction in the moment. So that the bejeweled Aphrodite means one has the enhancement of experience in present time. Experience is enhanced in present time. That's the bejeweled Aphrodite. She comes. That is one way of saying it. That is her beauty. She enhances life. She is an earth goddess. She is not just an object to look at. Three quarters of our difficulty with Aphrodite is over objectifying her, trying to carry her in a look, in our clothes, in our makeup, and feeling that she's never going to get out there unless we carry her objectively as a look. And I think as an earth goddess, she really is a soul goddess, a soul source goddess. And she has this objective side. She brings us out into the world of appearances, of illusion, of look. Yes, she does. But where she's most satisfying is when she's a source goddess, when she really brings one an abundance, I think, to the life of the psyche. Now, also the jewels, besides enhancing the moment, jewels speak of enduring value, do they not? And there is an enduring value that is with her. Even though the profound transforming love experience may not last, the value of it does. Now, we may obscure the value of it. We may lose it. And if the ego gets quite bitter about the passing of a love or the passing of a bright and beautiful part of one's life, if one gets very bitter about it, then one doesn't find the jewels. The necklace gets lost. But it really belongs to the soul. I think she is a goddess, so we're talking about eternal values. And it's possible to... I think that's where in the inner world one can recapture what the soul has gotten from this life experience. Not as an idea, but really in the ground of oneself. So I feel the jewels have that aspect in it. And then the jewels of Aphrodite have to do with the enrichment that the seasons bring. This is just analyzing it for a moment. the graces and the seasons. It's very curious to look at ancient Greek life and see how the seasons, who were called the hours, whom the Latins called the hori, the Romans called the hori, horai, H-O-R-A-E. It's curious to see in Greek life what an essential part they played. There was a shrine to the graces at Olympia, and every athlete passing through the narrow corridor that goes into the, arena or... what? Stadium. Would pass and make some offering, some gesture to the graces, because the graces brought gifts to life, and one of them would be winnings in the games, or the beautiful exercise of one's body and skills and arts. The graces were very much a part of that. They were often seen as present in sculptures, in a city political situation. The graces were prayed to and asked to bless the city. Yes, okay, the separate attributes. I think I'm up to remembering their names. Aglaia, Euphrosyne, and Thalia are the most frequent names used. Thalia is the blooming quality. Thalia is bloom, blossoming, bloom. One of the hours in Athens also took the name Thallo, which means bloom, bloom, blossoming. Euphrosyne is the joyousness. You can hear it. Euphrosyne. It has a bubbling up sea foam quality in it. euphrosyne, the joyousness in experience, the high quality that comes out of experience, excitement, euphrosyne, aglaia. And aglaia is radiance, light, illumination, aglaia. So they did have those qualities, and the hours in Athens, the hours were only two in number, and they were Thalo and Karpo. They don't sound like feminine names, do they? Thalo and Karpo. And Thalo again is bloom, like Thalia or Thalaya, and Karpo is the fruiting. Our word, the Latin word body, corpus, comes from carpo. I think it does. It's the body or the fruit, carpo. So you do see Aphrodite's cycle is implicit in these presences. And always she would take you from the bloom to the fruit, given half a chance. There can be many a slip before we get to the fruit. And we're so upset when we lose the flower. We're so upset. We're hard to deal with. And then one other thing about seasons. Aphrodite goes with the season, which is with the flow of natural being and with Earth's deep rhythmic support. And earth, for the Greeks, of course, as well as for the American Indians, as many of you would know, has the presence of the ancestors in it. So there's a long memory of human experience in the earth from those who've gone before. And it's a solid grounding part of ourselves. We're not completely autonomous from our ancestors. Kazantzakis says in his book, Saviors of God, at one point he said, you open your mouth and a grandfather cries out. Or a grandmother, or an ancient one, you see. Because it's all down there somewhere in that great. It certainly goes with Jung's view of the collective unconscious. And so, since Aphrodite is with the season, she is with Earth's process and Earth's way of moving and Earth's depth of memory. And there is by nature, I don't know quite how to say this, about Earth, there is a kind of amoral quality, right? I mean, it's not into ethic, but it's a very fated movement. Whether it's good for us or not, the winter is coming. Whether we like it or whether it supports our ego goals or the life of the spirit, you have to move with what the Earth says. So there is this movement in our natures. You can apply Earth to one's nature or the nature of psyche. Certainly psyche is Earth in us. That's why there's no transformation until psyche changes. The psyche in us changes. You can change a lot of insights, a lot of attitudes, a lot of programs and projects, but until psyche changes, the earth is the very same in us. Psyche is our earth. And you see that throughout alchemy, the necessity of the change in the earth, in the substance. That's the substance of us. Well, Aphrodite is a powerful mover in that substance. I think that's what I wanted to say. One reason, yes.
Does that imprint or touch at all on the mirror?
Yes. She certainly is a great earth goddess. Yes. Demeter is the goddess of the fruitful earth, right? So that she always brings about, sees things through the process until you get to the nurturing point. She differs from the original G or Gaia in that respect. Sees through to the loaf of bread. She was sometimes called the big loaf. Very fondly called the big loaf. And there's a lot of mystery. But there is mystery in the earth. And ordinarily Aphrodite is not regarded as a thonic goddess, which means an earth goddess, which means also underworld. Earth and underworld become the same in mythology. But I haven't seen one of the major goddesses that doesn't have some connection to the underworld, earth and underworld. Yes. Well, she, in her Nike statue in the temple of Nike on the Acropolis, I believe she held a pomegranate in one hand, at least on one of those statues on the Acropolis. I believe it was the Nike one, the victory statue. The pomegranate is very connected to the underworld. And there is a point where Hera holds it. She's not ordinarily an underworld goddess. And Aphrodite is seen handing, in a sculpted relief, of handing the pomegranate to Hermes. So it is... But Demeter has, through Persephone, through her daughter Persephone, through... She... penetrates the underworld, is really a guide. The Demeter mysteries are a real guide into the underworld and getting the return into the underworld and the return.
Yes. Did you say that Aphrodite was handing the pomegranate to Hermes?
Hermes.
And that, what does that mean?
Well, it means there's some exchange of the underworld fruit, because the pomegranate was the fertility of the underworld, and was very much associated with the myth of Dionysos, and the seeds of the pomegranate are the blood of Dionysos, with his shattering, with his dismemberment. And of course, in myth, the incident we remember most of all of the pomegranate is what?
Persephone
in the underworld being slipped a couple of seeds or whatever it was by Lord Hades so that he would get her back. Mm-hmm. He was concentrating on return too, but a different kind of return. Anything else you want to ask about? We should take just a little bit for maybe you'd like to say something in regard to what you drew yesterday. Some of you might like to do that. You drew those little slips of paper, and they were dealing with the images of forms in which love comes. And I particularly, we took those animal forms because these are the unfamiliar, one could call these the hidden forms of love and the mystifying forms. in which love comes, and might very well apply to the second coming of, or when the God, after one has gone through love and loss of love, a second coming of love is different, especially when the God is able to come. Anyway, I wondered if you had any response you wanted to make at all. Yes.
I'm in analysis right now, and to a point where I'm really sort of studying up for a long time since I've done anything around mythology.
Uh-huh.
And I just had recently understood that I was really a perfecting child, why I had abilities I had, why I was the loner, the outcast, all of these things. And I grew to perfecting it. And not only that, but I always have wondered why I had such a fascination with snakes. When I was a child, I used to wear garden snakes as bracelets. And to get the Persephone and have it talk about the serpent,
yes,
and being all of that was very powerful.
My goodness. Do you have that statement with you? No, that's okay.
Right,
does anybody have the Persephone snake statement? No, you probably didn't expect to bring it. It's something about the Zeus appearing as an erect snake,
mm-hmm,
in the cave.
And about indications of things to come, which is very true.
Indication of things to come, yes. Thank you. I'm glad it spoke to you. Yes.
I think the name about the graces, and I'm curious if this is a symbol that comes with the graces.
There was one about the graces, was
yeah,
there?
Was that an accident or Aphrodite come bringing with you the graces to enhance the moment once again?
Come, Aphrodite, come with the graces.
Come bringing with you the graces.
Bringing with you
the
graces.
To enhance each moment once again.
Okay, and you'd like to know what now?
It's a symbol. You know, you were talking about animal
form. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if there was a symbol with the graces.
But I can't think. Now, the hours often had a particular branch in the hand or fruit or cornucopia or when they were sculpted occasionally, but they have a dancing quality later on, the graces do. So unless you want to just take the name and work with it to get the symbol from that, one being the light or radiance, which would not be a solar radiance, you see.
Yeah.
Be a soft, more muted radiance. And one being the blossoming, and the other being, the joyousness.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
But I can't recall. I can't recall their having things in their hands.
I'm an artist, so I relate to the visual stuff.
I have a poor visual sense, and so don't always remember things. But I would work with your names to get their symbols. Uh-huh. Anything else speak to you? Yes.
One seems very appropriate. Mine was Zeus appearing to Callisto as the mistress of the beast. That I have come to unleash the hidden beast to awaken my central passion.
Would you read it again a little bit louder, Margaret?
Zeus appearing to Callisto as the mistress of the beast. That I have come to unleash your hidden beast to awaken my central passion.
Uh-huh.
And for me, I have worked with animal forms in these shapes for the last 15 or more years, and I've ever guarded it, and it's been my central passion.
Your central passion.
And then get that one is really good.
Yes. And he says, Zeus says, as in the form of Artemis, I've come to awaken your beast.
Yes.
Well,
found.
Yeah, yeah, your hidden beast. Well. That's good.
Mm-hmm. I got, once you were like the sleeping stone, cold and aloof after dying, but you are to see that you are awake and smiling. And it also seems, just like, to where I am, because I feel like I've been like in 18 years, and our first love was mm-hmm. We've had three children and they're small. Mm-hmm. For a long time I feel like I've been a sleeping stone in my wife and lover's skin. Mother took over. Mm-hmm. And just recently I've been working consciously and unconsciously towards, I think, that new love that you said. Mm-hmm. And it felt to me like the Aphrodite side was the side that was hidden. I hadn't reached yet, which is probably why I came to the workshop. So it seems very, and it's beginning to smile a little. I'm hopeful.
Oh, very good. Very good.
But it did puzzle me though. Because I don't think of Aphrodite as ever cold and aloof like
that. Well, she was. She had a name that I withheld, but I thought I wouldn't get by the whole weekend without bringing it. She was called Aphrodite Gorgo, which was the worst name she had, and it really means the Gorgon or the Medusa. And in that place, if Aphrodite were in the Gorgo place, she was cold and even thought of as dead or petrified. As petrified. And this actually also connects to the Adonis myth, especially on Cyprus, where it is possible, we're not sure, but the historians think that she, her figure, her body, was carried in effigy as dead, that she had died when she lost Adonis. She mourned and died. And so they carried not only the body of Adonis in the procession, but side by side maybe the body of Aphrodite. And then there was kind of a resurrection ritual. But as dead, and petrified, I mean, people also extended that to a very bad experience in love, when love got to a very bad place, as I have seen Aphrodite Gorgo. So she was resurrected on Cyprus. On Cyprus, they show her grave, they did in ancient times, the grave of Ariadne Aphrodite, because according to the people of Cyprus, Ariadne died there in childbirth with Theseus' child. They do not have the Dionysos aspect of the story as they did on Naxos, and she dies giving birth to Theseus' child. Theseus puts her ashore. It's very much nicer for Theseus' image. He puts her ashore because she is in labor. And there's a terrible storm, and he wants to save mother and child, puts her ashore and promises to come back for her. And when he returns, she's dead and buried, because she dies in childbirth. And Ariadne was fused with Aphrodite on Cyprus. So the grave was shown of Ariadne Aphrodite. But in any case, there was a resurrection kind of rite for Aphrodite there, along with Adonis. So thank you. That was a long story. I think it's really impressive to me how the synchronicity works, how people get something oftentimes that really speaks to them. So, whether coming as a bird or a bull or a Poseidon came as a horse several times, as a lover, as a white stallion. All of these forms, if you treat them symbolically, can really show you some of the force, some of the quality of the encounter with a god. You know, a bird encounter would be certainly much gentler than a bull encounter. You know, it just depends. Our problem is, or I guess we could call it a problem, is we don't usually call it God when it happens to us. Especially if the bull comes straight at us. But it does help to treat it, you know, in the larger sense of the movement of the greater self. And the self comes in all of these God forms. Okay, anybody else want to mention one? Or, yes.
I have
the cuckoo.
And Zeus the cuckoo, who had alighted upon Hera's voice, said, "I'm a very small, fleeting voice near your heart."
All right. Yeah. Yes. That's a relief from the bull. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Small, fleeting voice near the heart. Right. Yes.
My name is O Aphrodite. Bring your mirror close that I may glimpse the image of the little meaning to come.
Oh.
And it is simplistic for me, and that I am the something within me that I'm trying to find. It's still, I think, at the need stage.
Hmm.
It's just not formed, but whenever I am open to looking, there's always something that says, yes, indeed, you need to be doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
What they are, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned the quality of being open, because maybe that's what the mirror is about. Not that it presents something, you know, in all of its contours so that we can say, that's that, but more of an openness to what can carry the image. Okay, thank you. Yes.
I have Lila thought when she observed a great white swan coming toward her on the river, "You bring me perhaps the light that is shining, gliding upon the water." I really like that.
All right.
And,
repeat what Lita said to the swan, if you would.
"You bring me perhaps the light that is shining, gliding upon the water."
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I thought that you had said do a picture, so I sort of did that, but it was the swan on the water, and on the back of the wing of the swan is a red heart, and for me it was the love that you were talking about yesterday, but not the love of a person or the love of, but the bliss of going for making the change,
yes,
in life, and that's sort of where I'm at. I'm finding that thing that it's worth going for.
Right,
so
right, I like that. Great, great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the great thing about the swan is it does follow the natural movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just that feeling of later looking at the swan there, it sounds like it helps me see how what you were talking about yesterday, where not to think of Zeus coming as a swan to wait for Lita, but rather coming to have the swan to open her to the joy of the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And
then Lita let herself be open to it. Mm-hmm. And then she was able to flip the goddess.
Yes.
And
it's a very different feeling than the thought
that was. Jack, we were talking about the word reason abduction on our way here. You like the word persuasion.
Uh-huh.
Because there's been called the persuasion of Lita and the persuasion of
whoever, yes,
that would be the center.
start a new movement to call it that. All right. We were talking about the fact that am I cutting anybody off too soon? Talking about the fact that that the desire for Aphrodite's necklace is perhaps a longing in our times for the realm of Aphrodite. And there's another myth that shows, I'm just going to briefly read a tiny bit of it, just to give us the image. And we won't be discussing it at any length, unless you have a comment. And this is the wounded condition, I think, of Aphrodite in our time. I think she really is wounded. And so I thought it would be good for us to have the myth where this happens. This is from the Iliad of Homer. This is directly Homer's words, as far as we know. And what has happened in the battle between the Achaeans and the Trojans is that Aeneas has just fallen. Aeneas, who later became the colonizer of the whole south of Italy, there. Aeneas, who is the son, the mortal son of Aphrodite. Aeneas is her mortal son. She had him when she made love to the Trojan prince Anchises. Aeneas is very badly injured in the hip. His hip has been crushed by a boulder which Diomedes, the Greek warrior, the Achaean warrior, has let fall on him. Aeneas is fighting on the side of Troy, Diomedes on the side of the Greeks. I mean, there are Greeks on both sides, so I'll call him the Achaean. Aphrodite was on the side of Troy because of Paris and the golden apple and Helen, her gift of Helen, the love of Helen she gave to Paris. So Aphrodite rushes into the battle and goes for Aeneas and picks him up and is carrying him, tempting to carry him off the battlefield. Now let's see where it starts. She's carrying Aeneas. but Tydeus' son, who is Diomedes, the great warrior, second to Achilles. Achilles is on the Achaean side, and so is Diomedes. Diomedes is pursuing Aphrodite, who's called here Kypris, which is her word for Cyprus. The latter was pursuing Aphrodite with the pitiless bronze, knowing that she was a weakling goddess, not one of those who rule the wars of men, not like Athena, nor like Enyo, the sacker of cities. Diomedes pursued Aphrodite with his spear, and when he had pursued her through a great throng and had come upon her, then great-hearted Tydeus' son, Diomedes, reached out his spear and wounded the hollow of her hand. Springing upon her with his sharp spear in her weakness, at once the spear passed through her ambrosial robe, which the graces themselves had woven for her, and pierced her skin at the base of the fingers above the palm. The ambrosial blood of the goddess poured out, ichor, they call it, I-C-H-O-R, ichor, which flows in the blessed gods, for they eat no bread and drink no gleaming wine. Therefore they are bloodless and are called immortal. With a great shriek, she cast her son from her. She's wounded. And she cast her son from her. And Phoebus Apollo rescued him in his arms. In a dark cloud, lest any of the Danaans with their swift steeds thrust bronze into his breast and take away his life. Over Aphrodite, Diomedes of the mighty war cry shouted loudly, "Keep away, daughter of Zeus, from war and combat. Is it not enough that you seduce weak women? If you will enter battle, then truly I think you will come to shudder when you hear tell of war, even though from afar." And so he spoke, and she, beside herself, departed, sore distressed. The wind-footed Iris took her and led her out of the throng in anguish from her pain, and her fair skin was darkened. She found impetuous Ares seated to the left of the battle. His spear and his swift horses rested on a cloud. She fell upon her knees and with many an entreaty begged for Ares' horses with their golden frontlets. "Give me your horses, Ares, to carry me that I may go to Olympus, where is the home of the immortals. I am sorely pained by the wound a mortal man has given me, Diomedes, who would now battle even with Father Zeus." And Ares gives her the horses, and she is borne off with Iris driving towards Olympus with her wounded hand. And when she gets to Olympus, it is Dione who welcomes her. See? Someone was asking me, how old is the myth of Aphrodite and Dione? Certainly it's back in the Homeric age. And the myth of Troy would have been alive at least from a Mycenaean age, 11th century or so BC. So she arrives at Olympus, and Dione, her mother, took her daughter in her arms and caressed her with her hand and spoke and said to her, "Who now of the sons of heaven has done this thing to you, dear child, so wantonly, as though you had done wrong before the face of all?" And laughter-loving Aphrodite answered her, "The son of Tydeus wounded me, high-hearted Diomedes, because I was carrying my dear son out of battle, Aeneas, who is far dearest to me of all. For the dread battle is no longer between Trojans and Achaeans. Now the Danaans fight even with the immortals." Now, later on we'll find out what happened. But that's the wounded Aphrodite. And she's taken to the proper place to be healed, back to Olympus and back to her mother, back to the great earth goddess Dione, earth goddess and also wisdom goddess. How do you, what could you say about this wound of Aphrodite's? I mean, the nature of it. What will be the result of her, if she's wounded in the hollow of the hand, at the base of the fingers? Yes.
Blood, but not blood. Mm-hmm. Have you had any description of what it looks like?
No.
Like gold comes out or silver comes out?
And I can't remember that it ever said. But it was considered an immortal substance flowing in the veins. Yes?
Because they didn't drink wine. And why was it that it wasn't blood?
Well, because blood is human. They do not eat bread or drink wine. Yes, they are immortal, so they have ichor in the veins. What about this wound now? What about this wound? What?
A heart wound.
The relationships were being destroyed, and the Greeks were fighting the Greeks.
Heart wound, yes. Yes.
So it's not really normally doing the way you were.
No.
It's an erotic state. And it's a state that can be kissed by a human back of the It's like he's warning her off.
Yes, warning her off. What will she not be able to do?
She won't be able to hang on
without the let go. Yeah, right. She loses her power, certain power of holding. Isn't it? Of acting, holding in the hollow of her hand. Which, I've never given a lot of thought to that image before, but I think it must be very important somehow. And I think we might really just kind of take that as an image today of how the holding power of Aphrodite is very diminished in our times, in many ways, at least in the full stature of the goddess, that holding power, as a great majestic goddess. A goddess, we'd like to have love on our command, our decision. For love, she can be quickly wounded. She, it, can be quickly wounded by genuine hostility. Now that doesn't mean there's a place for conflict and struggle. But, I mean, bitterness, hatred, hostility are very difficult for her. And anyway, Aeneas is her project towards life. It's her only human son she ever had. And now she's dropped it. Dropped him.
I was wondering about the quality of love in sorrow in situations.
In sorrow.
Yeah.
Yes.
When a lot has been lost.
Yes.
Instead of experiencing bitterness, which is really been a very long year.
I think this is such an important comment. And I think we learned through the myth of Adonis, which we won't be working with so specifically here, but we certainly need to embrace that truth from the Adonis myth that the sorrow of Aphrodite is very important. One of her great images is as the mourning, sorrowing goddess. And she sorrows for the loss of her love. When Adonis is killed by the boar and falls. And as we said in Cyprus, she sorrows unto death. But this very sorrow, like Demeter's sorrow for the quarry, for Persephone, is a creative sorrow. It's not really feeling sorry for oneself or I think this true grief gets beyond the bitterness to a real celebration of what is lost. And so it gets into the praise of Aphrodite for what is valuable or what is lost. And, I mean, it's that kind of grief, I think, and it does, there is a healing that comes out of it. And in Adonis myth, the lover comes again. Adonis rises again from the earth. And I believe that that happens. I mean, believe that that's true. That's archetypally true.
Yeah.
You can't say, you can't put it in a given form. You can't say it has to be a man, or it has to be a woman, or it has to be a great creative project. It comes in hidden forms, but it rises again out of the... But if we skip the sorrow and just get angry, only angry, and never get to the true sorrowing, I think we miss the depth, mm-hmm. the depth experience of Aphrodite.
Mm-hmm.
But? You mean if you don't sorrow? Yeah. Yes, it's possible to stay in just a bitter place, and then you've got Aphrodite Gorgo.
Mm-hmm.
And you turn cold, and Aphrodite's cold. And so the sorrow is necessary. It softens the earth in us and sows the ground, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Interesting. I mean,
the bull?
Like, why she could be wounded, mm-hmm. and why she needed the horses together.
Mm-hmm.
And why, you know, why she couldn't be stressed, why she could have to struggle carrying her son, whereas at other times, I mean, she's a goddess.
Mm-hmm.
She could live in the world before.
Mm-hmm.
Why the storytelling, or the people who. You know, why do myths have these rules? Why Demeter couldn't send her daughter back? You know, there are rules, there are limits, and the meaning of why they set them differently at different times.
Well, there's a structure for the Greeks that's stronger than the gods, and that's the fates.
Mm-hmm.
Even Zeus bows to the fates. And the fates are the kind of fates, the Neri, and they are really the structure of existence. You could say, sometimes you could say they are the structure that the greater self determines. And that even the gods do not argue with that. There's something they bow to there.
I'm thinking of how important that letting go is.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of letting go and yet being able to hold on if
I Yes, yes. Letting go, too, yes, as well as being able to hold on, yes, she has that, she has that. The myths follow existence, and the gods are not magical who can redo existence. And so the Greek gods are very close to the nature of existence. It's just they have the extra dynamic and power to renew and to give life, but they're very bound into the human experience of existence. We see them through the lens of existence. The ancients saw them through that. All right, well, let's keep that in mind, and it's about time to take a little break, and shall we take just about 15 minutes or so? This is a picture of Hygieia. Hygieia, I guess they say in Greece, but Hygieia, sometimes called the daughter, other times co-worker with Asclepius. And Hygieia appears on the altar. The reason I particularly brought her, she appears on the altar at Amphiarion, you know, with the death of Amphiaraus and his reappearance as a great seer, the shrine was established there above Oropus in the pine grove, and it had a great altar in Hellenistic times, a five-part altar. And one part of that altar was dedicated to Aphrodite and Hygieia and Athena the healer. So it had a very strong emphasis on healing. And we don't often see this with Aphrodite, and I thought perhaps I should mention that because we're talking about the wounded Aphrodite. And I think Aphrodite is also important, not that just that she be healed, but she is often important in our healing process. You say, well, that's the same thing. Well, perhaps, but she's very important in our healing process. She was the third stop. Her shrine was the third stop on the road to Eleusis, to the greater mysteries. One would stop, the initiate, and offer an offering to Aphrodite. So she is a goddess of the sacred way. Okay? She is a goddess of the sacred way. Her temple was on the sacred way. Now, how that was understood, I don't know, but I think it's important for us, looking at it symbolically, to take that and struggle with what does it mean that she's on the sacred way. As one entered the sanctuary of Epidauros, which was Asclepius' greatest, came to be the most famous shrine on mainland Greece of healing, inside of Asclepius's, the Asclepion, was a shrine to Aphrodite that one passed first on the way towards the temple of Asclepius and the offerings that one would make and so forth. So she does seem to be on the sacred way and in the healing places. And even the sorrow that we were talking about, the giving a period, an appropriate period for sorrow, is part of a healing process, I think. One finds a certain point in one's life when one needs a new, this is kind of an astonishing statement, one finds a certain point in one's life when one needs a new, a different love. Aphrodite arises anew to be initiating goddess. If one can come to some measure of consciousness of this time, one may not have to leave a workable marriage or relationship or profession or occupation. One must be prepared for this love not to be a member of the opposite sex. It may come first as a member of the opposite sex, but one must also be prepared for it not to be a member of the opposite sex, but to come as one of these hidden forms that we've been talking about. In other words, not any image you have ever held of this ideal lover will it probably come in that form. It's quite unlikely to come in any of your prescribed forms. It comes in a hidden form, not to be at once perceived. And yet one is wooed, one is drawn. And I do believe that this is the time of the creative life, too. In the creative process, this happens this way. Now, we're not all ready for that or wanting that, but it also happens in the creative process. A god lover must come it requires a God lover, and one must find a context, a nest, a bed for this love. Every matured in soul artist of anything, has found this bed. And there are many ways of missing it and not getting the God lover. I mean, this is the story of our lives a great deal of the time. It takes waiting and a kind of intense ardor for the God to be evoked. An intense ardor on the part of the individual.
Did you say waiting and an intense ardor.
It takes waiting and a kind of intense ardor for the God to be evoked. I put down here invited, but evoked is really the word. Evoked means call, doesn't it? Call is more like it. Get that out there. Now, so I wish you would hear in a very discriminating way, as discriminating as you can, what I've said about the second love. And I'm also a great supporter of long relationship and marriage, and I'm not even talking about a relationship that will be permanently competing. Probably will be competing in the beginning. But when the God lover comes, the soul is wooed, and one's life takes on change. And eventually it can bring the benefit to the relationship you are in, if that's a workable relationship. Can bring a great deal of benefit and radiance to that. And it can unload the relationship you're in. You don't have to demand so much of it. Yes. All right. Now, that's an introduction to this myth, which was always a difficult one for me. Difficult for my own Hera side. This is the love of Aphrodite and Ares, the god Ares. Ares is the god of war. Okay? It is dusk upon the island of Lemnos, and Lemnos is in the eastern Aegean Sea, and a volcanic isle with caves, and there is where Hephaestus had his forge in all the myths. Hephaestus, the god, craftsman god, the god of the forge, the one who is lame and who is Aphrodite's official husband. Okay? So this is the island of Lemnos. Aphrodite stands at the gateway to the secluded house where in her marriage she dwells with Hephaestus, god of the forge. The house is situated high on a bluff looking out to sea. Someone is approaching, she said, but I expect no one. What a lively and bold stride this visitor has. Certainly it's not the slow, lame gait of my husband, which I should recognize at once. He wears gleaming armor, I believe, and a helmet covers the head held high. A sword is at his thigh. How handsome he is. But a warrior king come to the house of Aphrodite? And then he comes closer. Why, Ares, greetings. It is you. How unexpected, to say the least. Do come in. Aphrodite, I have found you. At home on Lemnos, yes. He gave her a direct, appraising look full of admiration. Since you have invited me in, I should like to remove my helmet there. No battle is to be fought here in the house of Hephaestus and Aphrodite, I should hope. Let me look at you. You stand before me dressed as a Greek lady, I see. Yet you are exactly as I always dream of you, with flesh shining and golden as though you just left the sea spray and stepped foot on some island. I have long searched for that island, Aphrodite. I did not know you had such eloquence, Ares. You reminded me of how it was being born on the sea's tide, how solitary I was, like an abandoned woman. And yet, so lightly was I carried on the sea foam as if I were under invisible sail. And then there was the sudden glimpse of an island shore before me, and when I stepped upon that shore, I knew that the earth beneath my feet was mine, and the joy of the earth coursed through me. That's how it was when I first came ashore at Kythera. For the first time, you say, you are truly a goddess of the first times, I am certain, lovely Kytheria. You shall believe as you like, Ares. So, observing the handsome couch nearby in the intimate room, Ares removes his armor and stretches himself out on the couch, his long, lean body at ease. Aphrodite's eyes grew large with surprise, and she was frowning slightly. Have I displeased you? It is that the couch has been accustomed to Hephaestus, the lord of this house. So, he grinned a challenge. So, the chair bends and bows to accommodate Hephaestus precisely and pleasantly, anticipating every inclination of his supple body. It occurs to me that you probably will find the couch a misfit. Not at all, not at all. He sounded expansive and a little amused. Actually, I'm quite comfortable. It amuses me that you find my presence so startling. You should know, by the way, that I have no intention of being like my lucky brother. Hephaestus? I'd quite forgotten that you are brothers, for how very different you two are. She shook her head incredulously. Tell me all about these differences. I'm sure that I shall be pleased by them. Are you so sure of yourself, Ares? Well, unlike my dear husband, you are ever bold, as you are wont to go striding forward, swinging your sword ominously. He laughed. I don't always swing the sword. Sometimes I bear it at my side, my lovely goddess. To me it's all the same. It was awful on the battlefield of Troy, so I did not stay around long to observe. Thank you again for lending me your chariot and horses to transport me back to Olympus. My horses also are bold, you may have observed. My reputation has been built on this attribute of boldness, I suppose. That boldness draws me strangely. You appear to me to be like the lion soundlessly tracking his prey upon the mountain, the muscles taut, ready for the pounce. I am a lion of a warrior. I am forewarned. With you I shall never do battle, Aphrodite. A languor, pleasant to be sure, courses through me when I'm in your presence, making me wholly unfit for battle. Yet, you are ever a warrior. Come, surely you do not doubt the words of a true lover. A warrior who loves is still a warrior. The battle is your bread and olive oil, Aries, he said. Perhaps you do discern me well, my lovely lady. I ask you, what better match could there be than war and love? We are the real guts of the cosmos, you and I. The human world sees us as the mighty opposites, the two rulers of life. Such a match produces a trembling in me. What I begin to see is that, unlike the other Olympian gods, your mind is all body. Well, I do hope you're flattering me, but I'm not certain. Aphrodite flatters no one. This you must remember about me. It is true that I may perceive a person with eyes filled with true praise. It is like panning for gold out of dirt and rock as the small hidden beauty of a person arises before me, a shining thing. I am inexorably drawn towards this beauty and praise it with all my heart. But flattery, no. I never engage in false words. Well, few manage to see with your eyes, then. You said that my mind is all body. What do you say of my brother, then? What of his body? He asked this as innocently as he could manage. Hephaestus' body, unlike yours, is all dreaming mind, it seems. You see, his mind is ever dreaming new shapes and forms to be given body over his fire. I was asking about his own body, which is famous for not being beautiful, if you will pardon my candor. She gazed at him for some time. There's only one standard for beauty that I recognize. It lies in the individual whose beauty is in question. If you would hear the truth from me, I can tell you that Hephaestus possesses the most beautiful Hephaestus body imaginable. And to think that body is dreaming mind. He shook his head incredulously. Few see things with your eyes, as I said before. Well, am I the judge of contest, or am I the goddess of love? I believe the latter, and I'm here to test out the truth of it, as a matter of record. You can be tiresome, Aries, in spite of your handsome and youthful physique. Yet, I am never boring. Remember, it is my bold nature that attracts you, even if it puts you off occasionally. Speak to me of my other differences from fortunate Hephaestus. Unlike Hephaestus, you are ever in the moment of action. The pounce, I believe you called it. Animals pounce too, of course. But one who possesses the light of mind reflects. It is Hephaestus himself who's spoken to me about this. The god of no action. You are very jealous today. He says that reflection is living twice. And the second time, one possesses existence more vividly. Since I am goddess of the first times, I know little of this myself, of course. Aphrodite, oh Aphrodite, you are the one who brings bounty to the present that's being lived. Don't allow Hephaestus to teach you how to live backwards, I implore you. Never fear, I shall never live backwards. The present moment is my time, and when Eros enters with his arrows, the cosmos comes alive and blooms with a new life and delight. Never doubt this. Aphrodite, Cyprian, stay in this moment we have. Speak no more of other gods who love you. The bold warrior king is before you, who loves you above all others. Be with me now. A blush stole over Aphrodite's cheeks. She lowered her eyes and a sigh escaped her lips. And slowly she walked towards enchanted Ares. I take it that they had a long courtship. And because she had children with Ares, the two sons, and then the daughter, Harmonia. And this is one of the myths that shows a love within a love, or a love at a different level from the marriage that's being obvious or obviously observed or lived. This was her hidden love. I'm not sure how I treated it as I could. I've never much liked Aries. I have to admit. Like all the other gods better. So it was very hard to yield her up to him. But that's what the myth does. Okay. Now, let's just look for a little while at, we stop at 12:15, right? Uh-huh. All right, let's look at for a little while at this myth in a little bit more detail. One way of looking at it is that this is happening not only in Aphrodite's world, but it's happening in Hephaestus's world. This is a change coming about in Hephaestus's world and what that would mean. Let's start with Hephaestus, and how is it that Hephaestus, who is the craftsman and the worker god, he works harder than anybody, any of the other gods. How is it that Hephaestus, who creates the beautiful artifacts, is lame and slow? Notice I didn't say why, but how. How? But you can answer it any way you like. What does it mean to you that he's lame and slow? He's the only lame god. And he's the only one with imperfection. Yes.
Margaret. Expecting what she said, that his body is all being in mind. Yes, his energy,
because it's crippled in a physical form, his energy then all goes into the making the ideas, the thinking, the other things. Ah, informing the new shapes and the... Mm-hmm. So all of him goes, passes into this creation, all right? Huh? Yes.
The wounded artist is a cultural motif. I mean, the back of his thought, like this, the Buddhist and Beethoven,
yes.
On the suffering and the physical trials.
Yes.
This.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. Right. So here's a god who can't run. He's able to hobble along, but he can't really run. So he would not participate in what kinds of things? Sports, or chasing, hunting, war. Kind of cuts him off from all those things, huh? And does it say anything? Yes.
I don't remember Lord ever hearing that he thinks of himself as particularly cynical and particularly annoying. And what she said about him, you know, we think of him that way. But you were inside his head, and maybe Beethoven's head. Beethoven didn't have to hear the music, he wrote it, though he couldn't hear a thing. It was like he was seeing with his eyes shut.
Didn't affect his, didn't limit his inside world, did it? No. Yes. My Donna.
In order to create something, when you create something that's beautiful, you almost have to have a sense of what is and is not beautiful. I mean, there's
right. Yes.
Creation. And if he were beautiful, like all the other gods were beautiful, and they were active, there wouldn't be that sense of difference. If everything's beautiful, then beautiful in the sense doesn't exist.
Yes. Right. Right. I think it's a very important point, yes. It's actually the opposite. And what about the necessity of creating beauty if you don't have it? I mean, I guess that's just another side of what you're saying. And is this his healing that's going on? Is this his constant healing in the realm of beauty?
He creates his own beauty.
That's right. That's a wonderful, wonderful image of the creative process, creative activity, and also the woundedness of one in the individuation process, I think. Crippledness, affliction, let's say, the affliction that out of which comes the enormous energy to make anew if one stays with it. It's interesting to me that we have all alphas here with the names Aphrodite, well, not Hephaestus, but Aphrodite, Ares, who else was I thinking of? And then Hephaestus, Ares and Aphrodite, I'll just tell you what her cousin Sacchus said about them. Cousin Sacchus was born in Crete, lived there, very difficult years as a child, went away to study after he got out of school in Naxos, and went to Paris and other places, became really very fine writer, you know, craftsman in his field. But when he returned to Greece, it was really an inner journey, an inner-outer journey. And as he went through the countryside, especially in the south of Greece, the great Peloponnesus, he said, everywhere I look, I see Ares and Aphrodite. The gentleness and beauty of Greece and the harshness and forbidding quality. And the land possesses both. And the vineyards and the olive groves and the seaside, it has the gentler aspect, but there's a lot of stony soil and harsh mountains and And he felt this very much, both in the history as well as in the topography and of Greece. What do you think that work? Let me ask something else about work again, Hephaestus and work. Do you think that work always goes best with this lame gait? Is there any way in which the lameness helps out the work process? Can you say anything to that? Does that make any sense to you? Yes.
I think it does, but I think that those highly creative people, for the most part, have a passion and a joy in their work that is such that they don't really see it as work. I don't know if you're following what I'm saying when you mentioned that about the creative part, I immediately thought of someone like Isaac Perlman. And here is this crippled man who is, it's so obvious, he's so overjoyed.
Yes.
With what he is creating that is his work.
Right.
You know, that it transcends. He's in this ecstasy.
How does it help us? How does it help us to be lame in the worker side?
It creates a space where we have to go more slowly.
Creates a space or a place where we have to go more slowly. We don't naturally like work. We'd all love to be great creators, but we don't naturally want to undergo the discipline and the tremendous investment of energy and time and the solitude of it. Yes.
I'm just aware of in my own creativity. My creativity often comes out of my limitation, my woundedness, and that element of suffering and not enoughness, and sort of that's where that's the, sort of what feeds the creativity.
Yes.
As well
yes.
as,
right.
You know, the entry, the mess of the God enters.
There. That's where the God enters. So in through the wound and also a sense of limitation. Through the limitation. Yes.
Long enough to finish
something.
To assure the gods that they are not trying to be gods.
Right.
You know, to acknowledge their own limitations.
Yes.
And that combination of the limitation and the creative act.
Yes.
You know,
that's a very good illustration. Really it is. Yes. So work is a kind of limiting, confining, enclosing process in a manner that gives enduring life to a thing, a feeling, an experience. At least creative work does.
I think
When we prefer to skip, hop, and jump, we have to move a step at a time. It takes great focus, care, devotion, and labor, and sometimes one has to really struggle with the swiftness in oneself in order to do a good work, in order to do a good, careful work.
Mm-hmm. I had some thoughts on the wording. I mean, I go along with the wording, helping the creativity, but mm-hmm. on the other hand, a lot of the wounded humans have overcome their deep wounds and they've become great artists. They've done it despite the wounds. And how many great artists were there that couldn't overcome the wounds and we never knew about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think there's anything automatic between being wounded and being creative. Or being afflicted and being creative. I think that's an important point. It all depends on what inner work one will do, whether one can bring it to the creative cycle. Yeah.
I heard someone say that they were very talented as a writer, but they did not know how to live each day.
Mm-hmm.
And just it's such a small amount.
Mm-hmm.
And having the discipline and learning how to live each day.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and Hephaestus, do you remember how he got Aphrodite? Well, he had made the mistake. Well, there are no mistakes. Not Greek mythology. He had asked his mother Hera one day who his father was. And I think he hoped it would be Zeus, and she would not, as is said by some sources, ancient sources, she would not meet the question and was very angered that he should ask because it was assumed that he was a son of Zeus. And that she threw him from Mount Olympus. And but that was supposedly not his crippling process, that he was already crippled, but she threw him into the depths of the sea. He was very happy down there. He really enjoyed himself, more than he'd ever enjoyed himself on Olympus, apparently. And he was taken in by Amphitrite, the queen of the sea, and the Nereids were very nice to him and paid him a lot of attention. He made beautiful things, artifacts down there for the sea goddesses. And but Olympus more and more missed him. It was while he was there also that one day he made a throne for his mother as a gift because she was very much into her sovereignty, he thought. At least that's the way he had been experiencing her. And so he sent this throne up to Hera, and it was very, very elegant, an exquisite piece of work. And she sat down and immediately and got stuck. And almost like, there are not many of the myths that have that. She got stuck in the throne. She could not get up. Could not get up. And all the gods and goddesses came forward and pulled on her and couldn't get Hera unstuck. So they had been missing anyway Hephaestus. He was quiet and didn't really hang around any more than he had to on Olympus.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.